Good morning, everybody. It is October 15th, 2021. This is the ADK Homeroom, your home away from homeroom. I'm your host, Frank, and we're going to do a little poetry on Friday. A fun Friday topic. I love poetry. I hope you do too. So lately, we've been hearing all about following the signs. It's almost all we ever hear, it seems like, sometimes. Gotta follow science, do what the science says, listen to the scientists. Let's do some poems about science. We have two poems from John Updike. Now I know you might be thinking it's Halloween. Of course you have to do Poe when you do science in Halloween season, because Poe did both science and Halloween. That's true. But everybody talks about Poe. And I hardly ever hear people talking about Updike's amazing science poems. So we're going to talk about that. And we're going to start off with the absolute best one right here. This one was inspired by a talk that was listed in the BBC's Radio Times. Updike wrote this in 1954, so we're in that post-World War II Cold War period. Same sort of milieu that gave rise to Hiroshima Mon Amour and Godzilla. And Updike's take on this, while he was reading through the BBC's Radio Times, the listings, and he saw a talk advertised. And the name of the talk, or the entry, and this is also the very first thing listed in the poem, Science, Pure and Applied, by V.B. Wigglesworth, FRS. Quick professor of biology in the University of Cambridge. Wow. That's ambitious, right? You can imagine what Updike thinks. You don't have to imagine, because I'm going to read you the poem. And you can hear what this prideful entry in the BBC Times inspired Updike to do with this poem. So here we go. I will read it for you. VB nimble, VB quick. Science, Pure and Applied, by V.B. Wigglesworth, FRS, Quick Professor of Biology in the University of Cambridge. A talk listed in the BBC's Radio Times. V.B. Wigglesworth wakes at noon, washes, shaves, and very soon is at the lab. He reads his mail, tweaks a tadpole by the tail, undoes his coat, removes his hat, dips a spider in a vat of alkaline, phones the press, tells them he is FRS, subdivides 6 protocells, kills a rat by ringing bells, writes a treatise, edits 2 symposia on Will Man Do, gives a lecture, edits 3, has the sperm club in for tea, pensions off an aging spore, cracks a test tube, takes some pure science and applies it, finds his hat, adjusts it, pulls the blinds, instructs the jellyfish to spawn, and by 1 o'clock is gone. Woof! What a great poem! I love it. Absolutely fantastic. So, what can we take from this poem? I think the first thing you can see is that we probably can't take away a must follow science at all costs attitude, right? This is kind of a takedown. A savage takedown, in fact, of science right here. What is he taking down about science? Well, first of all, the hubris, right? A 1 hour talk on science, pure and applied. He's going to fit all of that into just a talk on the radio, science, pure and applied. That takes some chutzpah. That takes some serious balls, folks, to claim that's the topic of your radio talk, science, pure and applied. And it goes perfectly, though, with the rest of it, because he is the quick professor of biology. And his name, my goodness, V.B. Wigglesworth? V.B. Wigglesworth, come on. That is a perfect name. You almost had to write this poem, didn't you? I don't think that Harold Bloom would say that this poem is inevitable, or the diction in this poem is inevitable, the same way that he would say something about Hart Crane like that, maybe, or Spencer. But I feel like this poem was inevitable once Updike or any poet capable of writing this poem saw such an entry in the Times. It just had to happen. Now, tied together with that hubris element, the pride here, you've got the speed. The speed of all of this happening, right? And the combination of hubris and speed, does this sound familiar? Oh, we've got this. Don't worry about us. Just follow the science. Yeah, sure, we did it quickly. But you know we're quick. We told you we're quick and we're FRS. We got this. So, hey, just listen to us. Yes, I think that does sound familiar, right? So next, notice the pure artifice here. This world has nothing natural that isn't run through the processor of modern society. It's all artificial. It's all scientific. It's all synthetic. Of course, that's not all bad, right? And the poem itself is full of artifice. You have this gorgeous rhyme, this gorgeous ornamentation. That's one of the poem's main attractions, right? And it subverts the dull science of its title character. This title character looks pretty dull, pretty obsessed with his tadpoles and with his spiders. These are gross things. Kills a rat by ringing bells. This is gross. Meanwhile, the poem itself is rather enticing. It has this rhyme scheme that's nice, it sounds cool, it's fun, the rhythm pulls you into it, you can gallop along with it, and it's nice. But all of the things that the scientist does in here, what he works with, tadpoles, spiders, jellyfish, these are all kind of gross things, and by contrast, this poem seems even prettier. So science, biology, dealing with the natural world, dealing with life, and Updike saying, you know what, we're not going to follow you. We're going to put some ornament on here. We are going to actually improve upon the natural world by making some rhymes, by adding in some meters, by speaking in an artificial way, not a natural way, by going arabur, against the grain, as Heisman's might say. And of course, Updike was very much doing that in 1954 when he wrote this, because outside, you know, maybe of Richard Wilbur and some other people that enjoyed form there too, of course, but they weren't the majority. They were definitely the minority in 1954. So what shines here in this poem about science is not the science, right? It's the art. And it says, science, oh, come on. You're too much now. This is a little ridiculous. Too quick, too confident, too overconfident. You give me a break. Take a seat. I'm going to show you what poetry can do. I like it, right? And it shows off through craftsmanship. So third, let's look at this craftsmanship here. It's iambic tetrameter. It's not pentameter, right? He cuts a syllable off, and that emphasizes the brevity of the lines and the brevity of the time Wigglesworth spends in the lab. He only spends an hour in the lab. The speed with which Wigglesworth works. Can we really trust something that goes that fast? He seems to be working at a breakneck pace, right? And then you have the rhyme scheme, which emphasizes the art over the science again and also makes it fun, and it adds humor in it because, I mean, the guy's name is V.B. Wigglesworth, right? Just like I think a couple weeks ago I did A.E. Stalling's poem Peacocks, and I said that, you know, you use the word peacock in your title, that's kind of like naming your poem Lake Titicaca. There are only so many ways that can go, right? And it's the same thing here, for sure. You're writing a poem about a guy named V.B. Wigglesworth. V.B. Wigglesworth is not going to be the subject of a serious, unhumorous, I should say, because there is some gravity to this poem, but it's not going to be V.B. Wigglesworth is not going to be the subject of a poem that does not have humor in it. You need to have some humor in any poem with a guy named V.B. Wigglesworth, right? So it's making fun. It's laughing. It's funny. It's making fun out of a bad science situation. And of course, they needed that, right? Post-World War II, nuclear bombs, science in question, Godzilla rising out of the seas because of nuclear warfare. Other craftsmanship points here, right? It's all one sentence. It again emphasizes the quickness and the brevity. Lots of enjambment to show the running on, the moving on, the rushing forward, perhaps to ruin or a ruined state, but the rushing forward. The diction is absolutely fantastic in this poem, right? It is spot on. You've got puns, really, like symposia and sperm club. And as I'm saying that, I'm thinking, you know, maybe the sperm club pun there, maybe that's a little bit why the poem was never quite the recipient of the attention that it otherwise might have deserved, right? Poking fun at the sperm club there. So great break of rhyme structure at spore and pure, right? You've got perfect rhymes all the way throughout. And then when you get to the word pure, that one doesn't have a perfect rhyme. Again, calling into question exactly how pure Wigglesworth's science really is, exactly how perfect his conclusions really are, exactly how well situated he really is to be the judge of the question, will man do? Oh, the arrogance! The arrogance. I love this poem. And, you know, that's just a great example of adding meaning through form. Poetry is language where the form has meaning. That is what poetry is. I'll say it again. Poetry is language where the form has meaning. And so the form of the language here, the pure and the spore breaking like that, the meaning is that not all that might appear to be perfect, namely Wigglesworth's science, is in fact perfect. And then, of course, I have to point out the final image here, this wonderful parting image of V.B. Wigglesworth with his hat on and you pointing back into the room, and he instructs the jellyfish to spawn. My God, man, the arrogance, once again, teaching nature to do what nature would do anyway. You do not need a guy wagging your finger at you and telling you, a biologist, an FRS fellow of the Royal Society, you do not need him instructing the jellyfish to spawn. Jellyfish are quite capable of spawning all on their own. So this is a great image because it combines all the different themes of the poem, right? You have the pride in the one spot. You have the science in the one spot. You have the rushing out the door in the one spot. And you have the nature versus science jellyfish, science trying to instruct it, but it's needless and it just looks silly to have somebody instruct a jellyfish to spawn. And of course, you have the wonderful ornamentation and the flourish of the artwork with the rhyme there. All these themes presented to us in this one last perfect image. This is good poetry. Really think that poem deserves a better position in history than most people are willing to give it. Okie dokie. Let's go to our second poem. This is another science poem by John Updike. And one of the reasons we picked it, or I picked it, is so that we can see, you know, the standard reasons. We can see the similarities, we can see the differences, and we can profit therefrom. So the name of this poem is Cosmic Gaul. It was written about 6 years after the V.B. Wigglesworth poem, so 1960. And it's about neutrinos. If you're not familiar with neutrinos from physics, neutrinos are particles that really have low cross sections with everything. They hardly interact with anything at all. They zoom through experiments. It took a long time to discover them relative to the other particles because they are so unlikely to interact. They are leptons. They're in the same class of particles as electrons, right? And you have the electron and the neutrino, the electron neutrino, and then the muon and the muon neutrino and the tauon and the tau neutrino as you go up in mass. But of course, all of the normal matter, the normal situation that we experience would be with the electron and its neutrino. So that's opposed to right quarks on the other side. So that's what neutrinos are. Super tall, super tiny, super hard to detect. They go through everything. We're still doing active research on neutrinos. And one of the things we discovered after Updike wrote this poem in 1960 is that there are three, like I was saying, three different flavors of neutrino. And the neutrinos can actually oscillate. They can actually sort of turn into each other and turn back. But Updike did not know that when he was writing this. So let's go ahead. Cosmic gall. Neutrinos, they are very small. They have no charge and have no mass and do not interact at all. The Earth is just a silly ball to them, through which they simply pass, like dust maids down a drafty hall or photons through a sheet of glass. They snub the most exquisite gas, ignore the most substantial wall, cold shoulder steel and sounding brass, insult the stallion in his stall, and, scorning barriers of class, infiltrate you and me. Like tall and painless guillotines, they fall down through our heads into the grass. At night, they enter at Nepal and pierce the lover and his lass from underneath the bed. You call it wonderful. I call it crass. All right, so that is Cosmic Gall from John Updike. Maybe not as great a poem as V.B. Wigglesworth or V.B. Nimble, V.B. Quick, but still an excellent poem. Let's go through. Let's look for some similarities. Let's look for some differences. These are both science poems from the same author written 6 years, say poet written 6 years apart. Well, one, they're obviously both about science. Two, they're both rhymed, which questions science in some sense and adds some humor into the mix in some sense and says, hey, look at me. I'm art, I matter too. Both of them do that. Both of them call to our attention the great fact about the human condition. Namely, physics and art. Everything else is just coincidence. It's true. Think about it. Physics and art. Everything else is just coincidence. Both of these poems are iambic tetrameter. Both deal with fast, quick, drive-by phenomena. So iambic tetrameter suits itself well to this quick-paced subject matter. Both touch on sex, which is interesting, right? Sex at the crux of the relationship between science and art, between reproduction and beauty. Both personify the hubris of science, right? The first one personifies it in VB, and the second one really personifies it, or at least concretizes it, characterizes it in the neutrino. The neutrino itself can be rude, it can infiltrate things, it can scorn things, it can cold shoulder things. So they're both lending some traits to science itself. And clearly in both cases, right, the speaker is criticizing at least some part of science. Here he calls it crass. A lot of people think that neutrinos are so wonderful. And the speaker is saying, well, it's really just crass. I mean, come on, you're just zooming through everything. You're not stopping to talk. Not too cool. And of course, in the first one, the tone is just mocking, right? The tone mocks Wigglesworth. So those are some of the similarities that we can find here. Some differences. Well, one thing interesting to note here, there are only two rhyme sounds all the way through Cosmic Gall. And we didn't have that in Wigglesworth, obviously. Here, I think the two rhyme sounds, right, they're penetrating. The same two rhyme sounds go all the way through the poem, just like the neutrino entering at Earth's crust, goes all the way through Earth and exits through the crust on the other side, just like the same way the rhyme scheme penetrates through the same rhymes, the same sounds penetrate through the entire poem. The poem almost looks like the track of a neutrino on the page, right? They're very narrow lines, and it's 19 lines long. Doesn't look like a chunky sonnet sitting there on the page. It looks like kind of a vertical path of an electron straight through, of a neutrino straight through the Earth. And, you know, imagine if he had known there'd be three neutrino flavors, he probably would have cycled through three different rhymes. Who knows? That's conjecture on my part. Maybe there's some interview out there with Updike where he addresses this. If there is, please send it my way. ADK Homeroom on Twitter. Feel free to drop it into my DMs. Feel free to call my attention to it. Tag me. However you get it done. But let me know if there is such a video out there of Updike discussing if he would have used three rhyming sounds instead of two, if he had known the three neutrino flavors could oscillate into each other. I bet he would have. It makes sense. It fits with the poem. So yeah, the two rhyming sounds makes it, you know, gives it a driving inevitability. It's like a juggernaut going all the way through. Also, it makes the poem pass by so quickly, you almost even don't notice it, just like a neutrino. But that sort of works against the poem too, right? I don't think that this poem either has enjoyed the attention that it deserves. Maybe to a lesser extent than Vivi Nimble, Vivi Quick, which absolutely deserves a high place in the canon, in my opinion. You know, Cosmic Owl, it's maybe not a perfect poem. You could pick apart some diction, right? Nitpick simply in line 5. I'm not sure what that's doing there. Tall in line 13. I could have done without that. Could have had a better choice there, maybe. But hey, these are choices that come with benefit as well as cost, right? And just like in economics, you know, poetry's a craft too. You have to weigh the costs and the benefits when you are looking at diction, looking at choosing a particular word. Some words might come with a cost, whether that cost is, you know, being awkward, whether that cost is an unfortunate allusion, whether that cost is an etymology that is perhaps not pointed perfectly at the meaning of the poem or the particular image or symbol that the poet is trying to get across in a place. But just because there can be cost associated with a word does not mean that the cost outweighs the benefit. Too often in poetry workshops, we hear people say, oh, this word is terrible, toss it out, here, blah, 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 blah. I can't even believe it. But then they don't even bother to weigh against the cost of the word. They don't bother to weigh against the cost of the word the benefits of the word. And there are certainly some benefits here. Tall, for example, is a rhyming word in this poem. So that's a pretty big benefit, right? Given the aesthetics of the poem and the goals of the poem. Judge it by its own standards. Don't judge it when it comes to craftsmanship, at least. Judge it by its own standards, not by, you know, your standards, if you are somehow biased against rhyme. And you shouldn't be, but if you are, you know, judge it by its own standards. And, you know, simply has some sound, right, and some internal rhyme, right, silly, with the parallelism in the line just before. So there are some benefits to these words, and they're not complete, you know, clunkers. You can see why Updike picked them, and it's important to remember that just because you can find something that is not ideal in a poem doesn't mean that same thing that's not ideal is not contributing a net positive effect to the poem. Some parts of it might be poor, but it might be that the item in question, the word in question, the technique in question, whatever it is, has so many good things that they outweigh the bad. So that's this poem. right? And it's a bit of a come down maybe from VB Nimble, VB Quick, but it is still a fun, fun, fun poem. And that's what we're going for here on Poetry Friday. If you want to read more Updike Science poems, the next one I would recommend to you, which we will not have time to cover here today, is Chambered Nautilus. You can find Chambered Nautilus online, of course. And to compare Chambered Nautilus, obviously it's a science poem too, at least in part, not as directly as these are science poems, but at least in part it is. And comparing it to Holmes's famous Chambered Nautilus poem, it's fun, a lot of fun. It can be enlightening and it can enrich your appreciation of both poems. And we all need a little bit of enriched appreciation these days, don't we? I sure as heck do. All right, I'm going to go out there. I'm going to take my dog for a walk through the leaves. We're going to run. We're going to chase that poop emoji toy that she really likes to hunt down and chew on. And then we're going to come back and maybe have a little apple cider. Have a great weekend, folks. Take care.